Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Well, we'll get your blood boiling a little bit first thing today, because Ali Mayorkas, impeachment pending, the Department of Homeland Security Secretary, the border guy. He was before members of Congress again on the Hill yesterday. And it was the usual alternate reality that he was presenting. John Kennedy, Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana, had sort of had enough of these proceedings with Mayorkas. So he sort of just established a baseline. Mm-hmm. Of what we've all experienced over the last 3 years versus how Mayorkas has characterized those experiences. And just cut to the chase. What is this really about? What is the fact that you have the same powers, you and the big guy have the same powers that President Trump did. You have more money, bigger budget, of course. Budget of DHS grows just like every other alphabet soup agency year over year. And yet here we are with historic rates of illegal immigration and all of the negative consequences that throws off. So what is this all about? Just admit it.
Isn't it a fact, Mr. Secretary, that the number of illegal immigrants that you and the president allow into our country counts for congressional district reapportionment?
Senator, I'm not sure I understand your question, but I can surely share with you that I disagree with its phrasing.
Isn't it true, Mr. Secretary, that the number of illegal immigrants that you and President Biden have allowed into our country counts for allocating electoral votes?
Same answer.
You don't know?
I don't understand your question.
Never crossed your mind?
The notion, Senator, that we intend to allow illegal immigration is nothing short of preposterous.
So you do understand my question.
And if I may, it is disrespectful to the extraordinarily hard work that we perform and, far more importantly, that the personnel in the Department of Homeland Security and across this administration perform to stem illegal immigration, build lawful, safe, and orderly pathways, and invest in a working system. And we only wish that bipartisan legislation, about which I have not heard a critical term,
Mr. President, Mr. Secretary, you're using up my time. You do this every single time. You do this every single time. And it's a fact, and you know it, and I know it, that the more people you allow into our country illegally, the more people are counted for reapportionment. And the more people that you allow into our country illegally, the more people are counted for allocating electoral votes. Now, maybe that's a coincidence, but that's a fact. And you know that. And you've done nothing. For 4 years, nada, zero,
absolutely false.
Zilch. And in fact, the only people I know in this country who are better off today than they were 4 years ago are illegal immigrants.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line.
I mean, the ease in which he lies is so infuriating, but he is going to be remembered in history as the criminal that he is. And I am glad that Senator Kennedy stuck it to him. That was awesome.
There's nothing intentional about it, really. So you're doing your best, and yet here we are, how many ever million, you know, the range, let's say 7 to 12 million people who've attempted to enter this country illegally in the last 3 years. And, of course, we know the number of gotaways is in the millions and so forth. But we're doing our best. It's not intentional. I'll tell you who doesn't believe that. A majority of the American people. Rasmussen survey out on that very topic, that very question, finds, and again, this is a disturbing minority that still can't connect the dots, haven't been beaten about the head and neck area hard enough in terms of trying to penetrate their consciousness with logic and evidence. 57%, 57% of the latest Rasmussen poll say Biden's goal is to let enough supporters in to keep the Democrats in power for decades. Right. Yeah. So 57% is more than Trump is going to get in November, even in victory. He's not going to get 57% of the total popular vote. So this is why, as we were talking about, Mike Scott was reporting on it yesterday during our show, that there's this internal strife within the big guy's regime as to what to do on the topic, because it is an anchor baby around their neck, if you will. And, oh, by the way, that sort of presented itself during Mayorkas's appearance on the Hill yesterday, where he said that sanctuary cities should work with ICE to have criminal migrants removed.
Oh.
And he also admitted that the surge at the border is now a crisis. This was an exchange he had with Ashley Hinson, a Republican congresswoman from Iowa. So now all of a sudden, you know, again, it's just, it's like Eric Adams a couple weeks ago, and he said, you know, maybe we need to do a carve out for our sanctuary city deal, where if you've been convicted of a crime, then we need to work with ICE to have you removed. You know, just sort of dipping their toe in the water, seeing if they can get away with it, if they can, you know, not anger the base of their party too much, the majority of their party too much, and maybe appease a little bit of the gushy middle enough to not lose this election based on a referendum on the border.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Our text line is up and running, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Dan, I don't know if you saw, but President Biden was on Univision, and he said that he doesn't even know if he has the power to close the border. Really?
We're examining whether or not I have that power. There's no guarantee that I have that power all by myself without legislation. And some are suggesting I should just go ahead and try it. And if I get shut down by the court, I get shut down by the court. But we're trying to work through that right now.
Well, yeah, get on it.
There's nothing to get on.
I know.
That's a cover story,
right?
Obviously. President Obama had no problem. And by the way, that guy was his vice president, in case he forgot. President Obama, you may remember, Mr. 10%, mm-hmm. You know, the follow up you never get from the D.C. press corps, Univision counts. So when President Obama announced, I know what I'm about to do is unconstitutional, but I'm going to do it anyway with respect to the Dreamers. With respect to DACA. Remember? Mm-hmm. Remember that, Mr. President, way back when you were vice president? I know it's unconstitutional. I'm doing it anyway because essentially of my general belief in the plenary power of the presidency when it comes to the border and border security. Right. He had the exact same powers that Trump did. And more money. But it's a cover story. And it's, you know, just like you heard Mayorkas tried to run that that ruse with Kennedy about the bipartisan legislation. If only we had the bipartisan legislation. If only we weren't dealing with obstructionist Republicans. It's not going to work. It's not working. It hasn't been working. It's not going to work. And the other problem they have is the lived experience of pragmatic Americans and what is being discussed in these communities. And I'm not just saying border communities, because every community is a border community under this president, but most in a most pronounced fashion with border communities. Like, for example, this firefighter at Eagle Pass, Texas. Who are you putting stock in? What this firefighter has to say or what these D.C. creatures say?
We're tired. The community is tired. Crime has gone up. Death is something that we're seeing every day. And it's very easy to watch something and make an opinion, right? But I'm telling you right now, it's been pretty bad for all of us.
Uh-huh. And the reports, not for only from their community and the high-profile cases of people in this country illegally committing crimes, particularly violent crimes, but also what they're hearing the world over. You know, because don't forget, Western Europe was way ahead of us when it came to the civilizational suicide of quote unquote multiculturalism, which is an Orwellian term for open borders. I mean, it's an Orwellian euphemism for open borders and for, as John Kennedy said, treating people breaking into your country better than you do your citizens.
New figures show a sharp rise in crime in Germany. Last year, police processed nearly 6 million offenses. That's 5% up on the previous year. Violent crimes reached a 15-year high. Nearly half of all criminal suspects do not hold a German passport, reigniting calls for tougher immigration controls.
Boy, who could have seen that coming? Nick on the Northwest Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, and good morning to you and everybody. I said in the beginning, when, as the administration calls these people the migrants, that these will be to the next presidential election what Trump, what the coronavirus was in the last presidential election. And what will happen is the people who control the mailing out these ballots, which is the Democrats, they're going to just start mailing out a bunch of ballots. Because it's your decision, you know, the way they make it look like, if you want to use the ballot or you want to go in person and vote. And they're going to mail out a bunch of them. There has to be more accountability and enforceability and some kind of legal penalties if they just mail them out wholesale all over the place. Because we've heard these stories in the last election where they were laying around in
apartment buildings. Here's the thing, Nick. Please remember this. When we talk about the election and we talk about it in generic terms nationally, like you're talking about it, we miss the point that it's a state-by-state exercise. And so what we're talking about is what happens in Georgia, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Arizona, maybe Michigan, maybe Pennsylvania, maybe New Mexico, maybe Nevada. And so we need to be very specific about what we're talking about and what we want to see happen and what concerns we have in those specific states with respect to how these elections are administered at the state level, because they can flood Illinois or California, or New York with all the unsigned ballots in Zucker boxes or whatever that they want. It doesn't change anything. You have to look at the specific states, and many of those states are not the same states they were when it comes to election administration. In 2020, they're not the same as they were back then today. And so Georgia has made improvements. Wisconsin has made improvements. They just banned Zucker boxes, for example. They just banned using third party personnel to administer elections the way that was allowed in 2020. So it's uneven, but let's be very specific so we have productive conversations between here and November. Thanks for the call, Nick.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender, Signature Bank.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. 3 years ago, Cook County Judge John Like was presiding over a felony bond court session when a 25-year-old man was brought before him on multiple counts of aggravated battery to police and resisting arrest. This is April of 21. Prosecutor told the judge, Judge Like, two cops pulled this dude over for running a red light, asked him to step out of the car. Instead, the man rolled up his window on one of the officer's arms. Yeah. And drove off as the cop's partner shattered the window to free the first cop.
That's nice.
The assailant later punched a police sergeant at the station lockup, according to prosecutors.
Getting better.
The defendant started to explain himself, and Judge Like, by the way, is a black gentleman, said, "I'm going to stop you right there. I'm going to mute you now." It was a Zoom call. You know, this was back when we were all... Oh,
they're still doing it in Cook County Courts, Dan, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
Just so you know. Yeah, talked to my attorney yesterday. She's like, I said, are you back yet? She's like, nope, I'll still Zoom.
COVID forever.
Yep.
Judge Like, let me explain something to you and a lot of people.
I love this story.
I understand your fear. Trust me, I get it. However, the United States Supreme Court, as well as the Illinois Supreme Court, have said if a police officer asks you to get out of the car, irrespective of if you think it's right or wrong, you got to get out.
All in capital letters.
Here I am. I'm a judge, and I probably know the law better than 99.9% of the people on this planet. Well, maybe. And if an officer stops me for whatever reason, asks for me for my ID, and I give it to him and my insurance, and in fact, it happened to me about a month ago, you know what I did? I gave my license and my insurance. He ran it. He came back. He said, sir, step out of the car. You know what I did? I didn't start questioning him. Hey, what you doing? What am I doing here? No, I got myself out of the car. Walk to the back, the cop told the judge. Yeah. Like, you know what I did? I walked to the back. You know what he did? He searched me. Was that a legal search? I don't know. I don't know what he had on his mind, but I didn't resist it. He searched me and says, Mr. Like, all right, have a good day. Did I kick and scream? No. Did I start quizzing him? What do you want me to get out of the car for? No. Because I know the Supreme Court said if police say get out of the car, you got to get out. You're never going to win on the street. Never. You got to come to court. And if you think the officer's wrong, that's where you air your grievances out. Not on the street. Because only bad things can happen. Luckily for both of you, the officers as well as you, nothing truly that bad happened where someone got seriously hurt. Is that the talk that mom and dad had with Dexter Reed? I'd like to know.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. No, I mean, and the press conferences that they had yesterday at the rally that they had, you know, the night before at the 11th District, no talk of that at all. Say, he got pulled over by police, he did not comply, and then he shot an officer. He fired 11 rounds.
Julius Reed is Dexter Reed's brother, apparently. There were protests on Tuesday
Oh my God. Did you
outside the Harrison Police District. And Julius Reed struck an officer with his arm outstretched, pushed the officer backward, according to a police report describing the incident. More officers responded, trying to detain him for battery, when he resisted by stiffening his body and pulling away his arms. He was unarmed, and then he was handcuffed and walked to the Harrison Police Station, where he was processed for a battery and two counts of a resisting arrest, both misdemeanors. I don't think this is the message is getting through to the Reed family. I mean, with all due respect, and I understand they're grieving the loss of a family member, mom and dad of a son. But I mean, again, the complete absence of confronting these realities. It's very frustrating because as I tweeted out, just thinking about it a little bit more after the show yesterday. Here's two things you have to believe if you are decrying the police involved shooting of Dexter Reed. You have to believe two things. You have to believe there is a scenario where after noncompliance with an officer's commands, someone can be, quote unquote, afraid enough to legitimately open fire on cops. You also have to believe that the police have no right to defend themselves when someone opens fire on them up to some undefined number of return shots per officer, since the press corps and the plaintiff's attorneys and the race hustlers are also focused on 96 shots in 41 seconds.
It's going around the world. People in Europe are talking about, what, for not wearing a seatbelt, he got shot at 100 times, almost 100 times.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. And you know what comes next, as completely anticipated. What happened after the police-involved shooting death of Adam Toledo? What happened after that?
Well, his mom finally came forward. He was missing for 3 days. She didn't even call police.
What happened with respect to law enforcement?
Well, everyone started crying defund police again.
Well, but specifically, we need what policy change?
Oh, you can't.
Foot chases. Foot chases. No, you can't chase suspects. Can't chase suspects. No foot chases. We were way down the field on eliminating car chases, and then it became foot chases because that was a foot chase. So what do we have now? What's the discussion now in this defund the police culture?
Get rid of tactical units and don't pull over somebody if they're not wearing their seatbelt.
Exactly. Tactical units are not tactical units.
They're hunters.
They're death squads.
Death squad, that's right. Sorry.
I mean, that's the way they're characterized. Again, this cannot be played enough. The grieving family, set them aside. How about somebody who holds a position at Northwestern Law School? This Sheila Betty woman?
Yeah.
We'll have to get that clip. Where's Sheila? Oh, here's Sheila Betty. Yeah, Sheila Betty.
Chicago Police Department TAC teams are out on the hunt. That is precisely what happened to Dexter Reed.
Mm-hmm. It's so irresponsible. Just
that's not, but she's not done.
Oh,
they're
sorry.
Out on the hunt.
Okay.
They're out on the hunt.
Okay, sorry.
The individual who opened fire on police, he did not escalate the situation.
Next, let's talk about de-escalation. Every single thing, every single police officer did in this encounter escalated it over and over. From coming out of the car with their guns out, to screaming commands, to brandishing their weapons inside the window, escalating over and over and over.
So this is a predatory outfit, this tactical unit. It's a death squad that escalated the situation because they are on the hunt, and Dexter Reed was, of course.
Then, of course, there's the use of force, which lacked proportionality. None of those officers saw Dexter Reed as a beloved community member, son, nephew. They saw him as prey.
They did not. I mean, come
predator
on.
And prey. Chicago police, particularly the tactical units, and Sheila Beatty, Betty Beatty, whatever, BEDI, I tweeted out her profile yesterday, so you can communicate with her if you want. Email, phone, office phone are there. And you can also communicate with Northwestern Law. And maybe Jelly Belly Pritzker. Maybe Pritzker, too, since it's the Pritzker School of Law. These tactical units need to be disbanded. And now you have the stories that come out. Let's continue the day two and day three stories. Let's continue this. Now we get an ACLU attorney who says, yeah, these tactical units, this bad old history of these tactical units, and they're too aggressive and so on and so forth. And this is not to defend bad behavior by police presently or in the past.
And we call it out when we see it.
Of course. Let's put this another way, too, just in terms of how much time we spend on this. You know, to say their names. I can tell you a name of a victim in a police involved shooting where the police officer was completely wrong. We said so at the time. It was a horrific decision that cost a man his life. Even though he didn't comply with the officer's command, there's no way the officer should have ever opened fire on him. And this was a decade ago, and I remember it like it was yesterday, partly because we spent so much time on it, partly because it was such a shocking error in judgment. It was a white cop and a black man. And, you know, search the recesses of your mind to think about, you know, any sort of race reversal and any name you can come up with, right? Everybody can come up with George Floyd because that went on for, it's still going on. And monuments and all sorts of other silliness. But how many people remember Walter Scott?
Oh, that was in South Carolina, right?
Correct. Well, yep, see, there you go.
That. And mm-hmm. He was, oh, that was awful.
So no one, this is not knee-jerk defending of police. But the only thing that is not proportional in these discussions, and this is consistent, is the response from these defund the police, even if they're using different phraseology these days, race hustling leftists who have grand designs to transform the criminal justice system just as they do the economy along identitarian lines. Decarceration, deprosecution, defund Democrats. And we're going to get to this a little bit later in the show, particularly when John Garrido joins us, retired Chicago police lieutenant. Just as we had the conversation about firefighters and the firefighters union in response to Jonathan Jackson, we have to have a little conversation about the FOP and their relationship with these defund, decarcerate, defund, deprosecute, decarcerate Democrats. Got to have a little conversation about FOP because accountability is for everybody. Jose in Dallas, Texas, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan and Amy, I've been saying this since 2010, 2011. You know, I don't know why they can't just say it. No more proactiveness. I think there was wasn't there somebody downstate who was trying to come out with a stop traffic stops? That's what's coming. Probably should.
Yeah.
And they're going to find out how terrible that is. They made a good stop. They found a pistol, and guess what? It turned bad on the cops. I feel sorry for them. Great show, by the way.
Well, he already had an illegal gun charge, so he knew that if they got him, he'd go back to jail. And he's 26 years old, and the family's attorney keeps saying he's a star athlete who enjoyed playing hoops. He's 26 years old. He lived at home. What was his job? I mean, his mom said he just bought her a Peloton. And he just bought a new car 3 days ago, but that car did not look new because it had side panel damage already on it.
Well, the family may be confused about his status as a star athlete because they are watching the media coverage with him in cap and gown, the picture of him in cap and gown.
I know, that's one they gave out. Yeah. Remember Blake?
He's an honor student.
The Kenosha guy, what was his name? Blake J.
Doesn't matter what his name was. Well, the Kenosha guy who mowed down all those people?
No. The black guy, Blake Jake. Oh, my God. He went to Evanston High School.
He
never even made basketball there. He wasn't a star athlete. He wasn't even on the freshman team. I mean, people, I know they're grieving. They can do things out of character. But don't believe what grieving family members say all the time.
Well, and even more to the point, don't believe the Chicago, Chicago press coverage of it. They're the ones platforming the cap and gown picture for a 26-year-old who's been arrested for retail theft and as you mentioned, a gun charge in addition to what he did there. And what's and that's the sort of the sum total of him is he graduated from some CPS school, CPS high school. That's a reflection of who police rolled up on that fateful day last month. Yeah.
He didn't have a job, and his mom said he would just go out driving.
Well, we don't know what he did, do we? No, we don't know if he had a job or not. But it certainly hasn't been mentioned. Steven Rozelle.
Good morning, guys. Maybe this Reed family will finally learn how to behave when the police officer who was shot in the wrist sues them for half of what they end up getting from the city.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think they're going to get money from the city on this, Dan?
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding?
Well, how much do you think they're going to? Oh, who knows?
They're going to get the city. This isn't going to be litigated. What? You're joking,
they're just
right?
going to settle. Yeah, I mean.
They're going to. The city will write a seven-figure check to that family. I mean, mark it down. Racial spoils political system. What part of that do people not understand? Roger, Southside.
Hi. Morning, Dan, Amy. When are we going to start talking about the ever-silent powers of Illinois and Chicago? I mean, because here, we all know what's going to happen here. Yes, I figure it'll be about $30, $40
million. Okay.
Whatever it may be.
Yeah, but who cares? You know who doesn't
care,
Roger? Right? Chicago residents don't.
I don't care one bit. And I'll tell you what, listen, until everybody, every show, every media, every resident here starts talking about the root causes, okay, which is the animal farm elected officials that we have, the radicals across the board, starting with Preckwinkle, Pritzker after that, and right down the line. And you know what? Everything else falls into play.
Yeah, except except they're not a root cause. If you want to talk about root causes, then who put them there? They're a manifestation of a problem, the people we have in office, aren't they?
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So on this fishing trip I did up north last weekend, at dinner, talking to some of the guys about Illinois, it was mostly Chicago, right, that was on this trip, mm-hmm. past or present. And I don't know how the subject ultimately turned to schools, but it did. And I was just sort of giving them chapter verse on what anybody who listens to this show knows about how big of fraudsters the suburban school districts are that you think are good schools. These government schools, and a lot of the private ones for that matter, but the government school districts that in the wealthy areas that are supposed to be so good, Fortunately, I live in Naperville, where we have very good public schools. Fortunately, I live on the North Shore. We have very good public schools there.
Dude.
I'm in Barrington, where we have, I'm
Excellent, lucky.
We got very good schools. You know, Glen Ellen.
Excellent sports programs, too. Don't forget that.
We have the good schools in Glen Ellen, the Glen Bart schools. You've heard of them? Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm in the suburbs. Oh, it's terrible what's happening in the city. Thank God I'm in the suburb where we have very good schools. And then you look at the actual report cards. And those are not report cards concocted by right-wingers like me, spreading misinformation and disinformation and threatening our democracy. No, no. That's what the numbers that those very good schools report to the very good Illinois State Board of Education. And we just pulled the data. And so the Wire Points, who put together a report card on every school district in the state. You go to right there, wirepoints.org. Mark Glennon, Ted Dabrowski, and the gang, they just pulled together the data and collated, essentially, something that any concerned parent could do, look up the data on their school, but they don't because their schools are very good. They've been told that. They have to believe that. They've spent so much money to be there.
They can't have it any other way, Dan. That's what the thing is.
Absolutely.
They don't want to investigate it because they don't want to know otherwise.
I went to Hinsdale Central. It was a very good school.
Well, I went to Hersey, and it was a really very good school.
No, of course. They all are.
All the
anywhere we went, nice. Anyone went in the suburbs, is a very good school.
Mm-hmm.
Except the data says something else. And I thought everybody was a man and woman of science and data, especially on the left. Especially the smart people, the experts, the credentialed in these wealthy, honky enclaves. So I had to disabuse my friends. And I mean, they're conservative, so they were, it's not like they were, there's a lot of pushback. They just didn't know. They didn't know. They didn't know that, you know, a third of the kids at most of these schools at least are not doing math or reading at grade level. They just don't know. And obviously it gets worse from there, including in some relatively wealthy areas where it's significantly worse. One of the gentlemen on the trip was from Evanston. I'm like, you may not want to, I mean, ETHS, that's not my play. That wouldn't be the play I'd make. How about Oak Park River Forest? That certainly wouldn't be the play I'd make. I'd sooner send my kid, if I had one, to a Maoist indoctrination camp than Oak Park River Forest, although they're almost indistinguishable, as far as I can tell. They have a strategic plan at Oak Park River Forest. Of course they do. They're visionaries. Of course they're going to have a strategic plan that's 4 years out. The high school's 2028 strategic plan has arrived. Priority number one, racial discrimination. They call it equity, but we know what it is. That's their Orwellian term for discrimination. Priority number one, identitarian politics at Oak Park River Forest. And anybody in Oak Park and River Forest that is surprised by this has been completely asleep at the switch. Oak Park River Forest will, and this is quoting, implement a comprehensive set of strategies and a resource allocation plan to equitably distribute resources by shifting school funding, staff, and educational programs from white students to black and Hispanic students. This includes replacing at least 40%, excuse me, at least 40, raw number. This includes replacing at least 40 white and Asian teachers at Oak Park River Forest. Got to get rid of the honkies and the Asians. And you got to usher in the blacks and the Hispanics.
What?
Because that's the way you reflect the diversity of our student population. Get rid of 40 whites and Asians. Doesn't matter their performance, you know, what their quality is.
They're successful teachers and the kids love them. And they're effective at their job. Just because they're white, they're going to lose their job.
Well, I'm not stipulating to any of that. I'm not stipulating that they're good teachers, they're effective at their job, or anything of that the sort. Oak Park River Forest is a terrible school. What I'm saying is, there's nowhere that you should take that default position. Nowhere. Everything should be questioned now. Oh, these are great. Everybody's a great teacher trying their best. Some are. Some are not. Individual basis. I'm not giving anybody the benefit of the doubt, and I would caution everybody else to do the same. 40 white, the point is not whether they're good or not. The point is it doesn't matter. They're white and Asian. They got to go because we need more blacks and Hispanics. Maybe the blacks and Hispanic teachers they hire will be better. Maybe they won't. Doesn't matter. That's the point. Reflecting the diversity of our student population. Direct quote. That's the point. They also are going to enroll more black and Hispanic students in honors and advanced courses by June of 2026, ensuring, quote, a majority of black and Hispanic parents and non-English speaking parents are satisfied or very satisfied with communications. What? Is anything about developing kids intellectually? No. You won't find that in the strategic plan. By the way, Oak Park is 53%, the student body, 53% white, 20% black, 15% Hispanic, 4% Asian. The faculty, 75% white, 9% black, 9% Hispanic, 4% Asian. So the Asians are properly represented because it's just a numbers game. If there's 4% of Asian students, you have to have exactly 4% of Asian teachers. Whites are overrepresented, 53% white, but 75% honky teachers. You got to get rid of some honky teachers. 9% black, but 20% of the student body is black. So you got to add black teachers up to get up to 20%. 9% Hispanic faculty, 15% Hispanic students. You got to get up to 15%. Doesn't matter what the impact will be. It just has to be exactly representative or better in the case of minorities because they're historically disadvantaged. They're part of oppressed classes and so forth. So we will accept overrepresentation of the people that we designate as oppressed. That's the program. That's the vision for Oak Park River Forest over the next 4 years. Wonderful, isn't it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Funny thing about Oak Park River Forest. The test scores have fallen since the start of the racial equity plan implementation, which began in earnest when labor union lobbyist Ralph Martiri, Illinois Budget Tax and Accountability outfit that he runs, he joined the school board in 2018. So this has been underway for 6 years. I think it's enough of a probationary period to do a stop, look, and listen, don't you? By the way, if you want fun back and forth on Illinois fiscal policy and finances, Martiri and I debated at the Union League Club several years back, and it's really something to behold because it's a real mind's eye into the mentality of the government-centric ruling class in the city and the state and in Oak Park River Forest. So where do we stand? Well, in 2023, only 10% of black OPRF students were at grade level for math. That's ISBE. That's down from 18% the year before Ralph Martiri joined. That's down from 18% in 2017, the year before Martiri joined the board, and they moved in the direction of racial equity. So racial equity, it was 18%, but pre-racial equity, 18% of black students were at grade level for math after they started to equalize everything and eradicate systemic racism and provide the necessary resources to black students and so forth. It dropped to 10%. Bang up job. Nobody cares. Doesn't matter because we're too busy congratulating ourselves for how enlightened we are. And that's what every one of these school districts is doing to varying degrees. Every single one of them.
Equity champions, yes.
OPRF has also seen decline in math scores for white students. 63% at grade level. That's down from 75% in 2017. Hispanic students are at 40% math at grade level. That's down from 49% in 2017. So it's what achieving equity. Achieving equality, the equal misery, the equality of misery, which is exactly what collectivism promises. Well, it may not promise that, but that's actually what it delivers, as Winston Churchill observed so many moons ago. The gospel of envy, the creed of ignorance, equity, synonym for equal outcome, synonym for equal miserable outcome. Martiri, now we have not only what we're going to measure, but how we're going to measure it and what sort of initiatives the administration is going to bring to the table, and they will have to be evidence-based. That was a big deal. No other district has that, and we've got that. Yeah. Just paper over these catastrophes, all at the hands of identitarian ideologues, with all sorts of gobbledygook about everything is going to be measured and it's going to be evidence-based, and don't you worry, we're experts and we're doing this and we're going to accomplish that, and pay no attention to the outcomes. Pay attention to the facade that we stand up of how many more black teachers or Latino teachers, how many fewer honky teachers, and so on and so forth. That's what's important. The board members, insurance agent Fred Arkin. Maybe you know them in Oak Park River Forest. When you see him, say, hey, way Fred. To go, Fred Arkin. Lawyer Tim Brandhorst. Way to go, Tim. These are accomplished professional people.
They're your betters.
No question about that. Supply chain consultant Graham Brisbane. Supply chain executive Tom Kofsky.
I think I went to prom with him. Okay, go on.
No, swing a dead cat in this region. College professor Jonathan Livingston. Human resources executive Audrey Williams Lee.
I was waiting for a woman.
Exactly. We have to talk about this board. Board isn't representative.
Start with yourselves there, honky white men.
And my favorite board member, my favorite current board member at OPRF.
See it.
Erotica author Mary Ann Mohanraj. You may remember Mary Ann Mohanraj, the erotica author. Mm-hmm. Fabulous. She was invited a couple of years ago to be the commencement speaker at OPRF. Of course she was. What a get. Mary Ann Mohanraj, erotica author. Her commencement speech to the class of 2023.
My son had a tough time in kindergarten. Anand got called into the principal's office 17 times for disciplinary infractions. And at one point, even got into a shouting match with the vice principal in the cafeteria. He was 5. Anand was struggling, and for a parent, that's really scary. It was also confusing because at home, he was a sweet kid with a strong sense of justice and fairness. Why did he keep getting into trouble at school? My husband is white, and Anand is not as dark as me, but still darker than some of his classmates. I couldn't help wondering whether his brown skin influenced how quick people were to assume he was violent, that he was the troublemaker in class.
Oh, she's sick. That's disgusting.
She's not sick. She's an educator. She's an erotica author. She's a school board member at OPRF.
Married to a white man whose kid is not as dark, and that's maybe why he got in trouble? No, he's 5 and he's shouting at the vice assistant principal.
Yeah, but he's shouting social justice tropes. Oh, yeah. I had a nice little 5-year-old social justice warrior, but then he ran afoul of the power structure in kindergarten because he's too brown. I couldn't help but wonder. She challenged the class of 2023 at OPRF with powerful thought experience during this riveting commencement.
Who's excluded by our country's immigration laws? What is the purpose of nation states? Should we have borders at all? I don't know the answers to those questions, but I knew that we should. I do know that we should be asking them, questioning the stories we've grown up with.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I mean.
Uh huh.
If I was there, I probably would have walked out.
Ugh. Roger DeKalb, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Process.
Hey, yeah, so that they've been spreading that love all over for a long time. 2018, DeKalb elected a new school board, 4-3, four super progressives. First thing they did was move to get rid of the superintendent that everybody liked. He was a great guy. Teachers, everybody. Six candidates finalized. The candidate the teachers didn't want, the recommendations, they picked Minerva Sanchez Garcia from Oak Park River Forest, a doctor of education and a social justice expert.
Yeah.
And man, have we paid the price since. Yes, doctor of education. So this monster, so DeKalb came at 13% and 14% in the reading and math. DeKalb, we're 65% of the kids live below the poverty level, if you can believe that, because we have the second largest public housing development on one property in the state in DeKalb, city of 45,000 people, 65% under the poverty level. The schools are a nightmare. So it came out 13% to 14%, and this superintendent's comment was, it was in the paper, it was in the DeKalb Chronicle, another fine, you know, whatever that Shaw Media garbage paper is, and that you know, mediocrity was a good thing to try to achieve, but sometimes you just don't make it. It was a total meh statement. They just signed, so the whole town's in an uproar. You think you're hearing, oh, they're going to get rid of their, they just signed around for two more years. So, and the, her philosophy of discipline is, if you were raised in a tough environment with a single parent and you didn't really have any discipline, well, then you got to go easier on those kids. It's like, oh my God, the discipline program these progressives put in was written by two Western Illinois and one Northern Illinois social justice professors. So it is like DeKalb has become a nightmare. Schools are incredibly dangerous and stupid. It's unbelievable. And who's paying the price? All these minorities, they moved out here from the city, you know, the big purge to like make Chicago look better. It is just, and it's not fair to these people, because you might have 50 people and 5,000 are just ruining the whole community. It's incredible.
Thanks for the call, Roger. Appreciate it. That's boy from the exurbs from DeKalb. But no. Where you don't understand, Dan. Where I am, I know the teachers. I know some of the school board members. I pay attention. No, it's not this. It's not like that where I'm at. Yes, it is. They may be better at couching it. It may not be as pronounced as what you just heard from Roger and DeKalb. It's just the system. This is what the system produces. It won't produce it evenly because there's a lot of variables. But this is what the government school system produces in a state dominated by the left. So, you can choose willful blindness. Many do. But I'm here to tell you, if you think it's not happening where you are, you're wrong. Dead wrong. Brian in St. John, Indiana.
Hey, good morning. Speaking of DeKalb, I was working at one of the schools out there a few years ago, and they had pride flags all over the place, so whatever that's worth. But the reason I called is I was working at the Flossmoor Public Library this week. Don't forget about libraries. I got off the elevator on the second floor of the children's section, and right there, front row center, there was a bunch of pamphlets and brochures specifically for teen pregnancy, leading kids to Planned Parenthood. There was a brochure about gun violence, nothing about gun safety. And then there was, of course, your LGBTQ pamphlet and brochure, you know, to let little kids know that they have options and what they want to be when they grow up. So don't forget about the libraries. That's all I got.
Oh, yeah, the libraries. I mean, it really is like Dear Leader type stuff propaganda that is being pushed in. Not even getting beyond the issue areas of identity politics. Dear Leader propaganda that I'm talking about. Like something you would see in communist China. Mm-hmm. You think I'm exaggerating? Libs of TikTok had this. Received this from a teacher in a California elementary school. First graders are being given an assignment praising Governor Newsom for being a, quote, champion for people's rights and they are asked to list praises for him. She screenshotted a picture from this this manual, this book.
Gross.
It's a picture of Gavin Newsom, full Patrick Bateman. Citizenship, quality, respect for the rights of others. Gavin Newsom, champion for people's rights. Biographies tell stories. They can show how people cause change. Gavin Newsom was mayor of San Francisco. Gavin said people could marry who they choose. Sometimes Gavin helped marry people. Some marriages were not between a man and a woman. He made sure that people's rights were respected. Write about changes Gavin Newsom made as mayor to respect people's rights. And then you have blank lines to fill in the blank. Talk about it. Turn and talk to a partner. Tell how you respect the rights of others. Turn and talk to your partner in first grade and tell your partner how much you love Gavin Newsom, our dear leader.
Oh, that's brainwashing. That's sick.
And
that's communism. You're right.
And I'm looking forward to those being added from Jelly Belly Pritzker to the course offerings in government schools mandated.
Well, yeah, because he's got to keep up with the Joneses. I mean, if Gavin Newsom's doing it, he's got to get on it.
Got to keep up with the Newsoms. Absolutely.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Have you or someone you know hosted one of these race to dinners?
It's called race to dinner. I race to dinner when I'm hungry. Hey-o! No, I've not heard of this race to dinners thing.
I can't imagine that somebody out there is unfamiliar. Probably one of your friends, yes.
Yeah.
Is unfamiliar with this. Race to dinner. Race, the number two, dinner.
Race to dinner, okay.
It's a double entendre. Race to dinner. For the low, low price of $5,000, you can get identitarian absolution if you host one of these dinners for honky wine moms of the Mercedes Marxist variety.
So this is you're becoming paying somebody to come to your house
and tell you how racist you are. That's okay. Right.
Do they cook the meal too for this $5,000, or that's separate?
No, you cook the meal.
Okay,
you're paying $5,000 to host all of your ghastly, awful friends, honky friends, in, let's say,
Lakeview.
I mean, it could be Lakeview.
It probably is. I bet.
Could be a lot of places. Could be Naperville. Mm-hmm. Could be Glen Ellen. Could be Hinsdale, of course. Wilmette. So you get the sense. So you get around a table. And then you bring in a black or brown lady or two, and they tell you what a racist POS you are for an hour or so. And then you are conferred absolution as long as you go forward and screech at other people the way that they screech at you. You have to screech it forward.
White women are socialized to be nice. And part of that niceness means you don't come to a beautifully prepared dinner table and then leave because something upsets you. So we know they'll stay. So that's why we use the dinner. How many of you at this table think that you're racist?
Welcome to Race to Dinner.
How many of you at this table, you nice white people, would actually happily trade places with a black person in this society?
Nobody raised their hands.
Disclaimer, the following contains blunt and honest conversations about racism.
We have the hostess prepare a crying room, so when your white lady feelings get hurt, you can go in the room and have at it.
Disclaimer, no white women were harmed in the making of this report.
In 30 seconds, we establish, that you all are racist, and that you know the hierarchy. Black at the bottom, white at the top, and the rest of us somewhere in between.
The goal is to have radically honest conversations. You know, I'm old enough to have demonstrated and marched in the 60s, okay? And what I know is, as a society, we don't have honest conversations about race.
During Cyber Rao's unsuccessful run for Congress in 2018, she found her schedule overflowing with coffee dates and campaign events.
At every event, line of white ladies wrapped around the door waiting to talk to me, to tell me, not me, not all white women. My platform was anti-racism. Not me, you've got me wrong.
Denver native Regina Jackson worked on Cyber's campaign and thought to consolidate these one-on-one anti-racism discussions into a dinner.
So we did it. We just did one of these dinners, and it was full white women, the Broadway musical. You know, crying, arms folded, eyes rolled, pacing around the dinner table, and we posted about it on Facebook, and it went viral.
I should have educated them.
The dinners, which continue to grow in popularity, have taken place from Denver to Chicago to Toronto. A white woman chooses to host at her home for a group of seven friends. The price of the two-hour dinner, $5,000.
You know why people are worked up about this? Because white people think that them doing this work is charity and we should be paying them. So even a penny would be too much.
Thank you.
Race to Dinner's message can now be consumed through a New York Times bestseller and a documentary.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Want me to sign your book?
All geared for white women who acknowledge their unchecked biases and are looking to purge the Karen inside of them.
Are you looking to purge the Karen inside of you? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. You said Chicago was called. You heard it. So it's happened here.
Oh, dear Lord. Oh, my God.
How many of you are racist? Like the four of the seven raised their hands. I'm supposed to say yes, right? How many of you would trade places with a black person? Nobody raises their hands. Really? Now, how many of you would trade places with, like, Naomi Campbell? How about Oprah?
Yeah.
You know, or maybe Slim Oprah back in the day.
Cheater. She's a cheater.
Yeah. I don't
Weight
know.
Weight Watchers, my blank.
Right. I mean, how about, well, maybe probably not.
Gil King.
I mean, Condi Rice. We could go on and on
right.
But yeah, but whatever. Viola Davis. Serena Williams. No takers. Nobody. Okay.
And this is for real. This is not satire.
It's for real. There's a book. There's a documentary. The New York Times is profiling it. It's radiating all over the country thanks to social media. And it's for the low, low price of $5,000. And don't tell me. I mean, honestly, this is like the school thing. Don't tell me that you don't know what I'm talking about, because this is everywhere, especially. And, you know, a lot of our listeners live in these godforsaken wealthy enclaves that are dominated by these harridans like the ones hosting these dinners. So don't tell me you don't know what I'm talking about. I know you do. I know who some of them are. Matt, Birmingham, Alabama.
Do you notice that all of these things take place up north? Denver, Chicago, Toronto, Boston. We moved from Geneva to Charlotte to Birmingham. And there are more African-Americans and people of mixed race in my development in Birmingham than an entire city and town of Geneva and St. Charles combined. And I sit here and see these people completely capitulate to their inner racist feelings, and they go ahead and get these dinners together. I'm like, you know what, people, just get along. Stop seeing race and just deal with each other on a human level. They just don't get it, especially up north.
Thanks for the comment. Well, that's because it's invented.
I just can't believe they'd pay $5,000 to be abused at dinner.
Wait, no. To be absolved.
Oh.
They're paying for absolution. That's what they're paying for. And they're paying for inclusion.
Oh,
remember
yeah.
what David Mamet said about Hollywood? The thing they fear the most is to be excluded. Ah. So whatever I have to do to stay with the in crowd, whatever I have to do to be on the side of what society says is right, and society, by society, I mean, you know, what I hear on The View, what I hear at Starbucks. I mean, their societies are very small, insular places. But to Matt's point, so that's an important point, actually, that's raised there. The other important point, Matt, what I was getting to with Matt, the reason, you know, you don't see it, Charlotte, Birmingham, actually integrated communities as opposed to the most segregated city in America de facto, which is Chicago. And yeah, in all of these, you know, wonderfully diverse communities like Hinsdale and Highland Park. Yeah. Kenilworth. Oh, wonderfully diverse. Yeah. My ass. So point is, it's invented. Most of this is invented. The way that regular human beings interact with one another has nothing to do with race to dinner, has nothing to do with how the media covers race relations. Just like the media creates alternative worlds on a range of other issues, they have done so with race relations. Remember that their goal in service of the race hustlers is also absolution, is also inclusion. And in order to get there, again, America is irreparably stained, hardwired into our DNA. It's systemically racist. It's still 1960 Selma, and we'll let you know when it isn't.
I'm starting to think that they're America's most dangerous voting bloc.
These are people who are the useful idiots to the race hustlers who use race for political power. That's what the new Marxists do. That's what identitarianism is. It's a political power play. This is clear, not, isn't it?
312-642-5600 if you cannot get a line because their lines are jammed. Text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Candace, Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin.
I'm so glad I already did my penance by living on the South Side for 10 years. And boy, was that a real wake up, because I was one of them fresh out of Northwestern when I got down there. And I thought all these people were in my house, and turns out they weren't. And so now I'm going in the totally opposite direction, which is anti-communism. And I'm moving down to a rural area. And I don't really care anymore. I see this for what it is, and people keep talking about this, but they don't understand we're going through a revolution. They're so stupid.
Thanks for the call, Candace. I want to host I think AM560 should do a race to dinner on the North Shore.
Okay.
And, I mean, if we can get one of the race to dinner broads, do they like to be called broads?
No, probably not.
If we could get one of those broads, chicks, babes, honeys, sweetie pies, if we can get one of them to join us, that'd be all the better. That'd be a fun dinner. Probably be a food fight, but it'd be fun.
Text message, Dan and Amy, I'd rather trade places with the black woman that's getting paid $5,000 to be annoying. Because the money goes to them. I mean, they make the money.
The black women who are there to tell you how racist you are make the money.
Right, yeah. But yeah, then he's saying, like, yeah, I'd want to trade places with you. You're getting paid $5,000 to be an annoying dinner guest.
yes, yeah. Yeah. Are you racist? You're all racist. Really?
Raise your hand.
Huh. Boy.
Well, pass the potatoes.
We're firing out of the gate here tonight. Okay. All right.
How insufferable.
No, that would we need to figure out a way to combine forces here. Because, I don't know. I mean, you know, if all you have to do is offer phony absolution to a phony crisis, and you get $5,000. I mean, that's not bad business model, you know. I don't know. And I'll pick out the wine too.
Oh, okay.
I'll throw that in there.
So nice of you, Dan.
Dawn in Naperville.
Once you learn to read, you will forever be free. Guess who said that? And how many years ago? That was Frederick Douglass.
Mm-hmm.
And we still have the same problem. So if you want to go after education through the lens of whatever these people are doing, you are cowards, because you're not addressing the fundamental issue. And you want to know why they don't address the fundamental issue? Because they don't want to admit they're wrong. They don't want to admit that Fontenot and Pinnell is a failure. And that's what they keep throwing their money at. And you want to know what the problem is in our school system? They tend to focus on the gifted. And the kids who aren't reading, they get thrown into a classroom or thrown and set aside. That is you want to talk about equity and equality? If equity and equality was realistic in Illinois, they wouldn't focus on therapeutic day school. They would focus on children being able to read and write and function independently. And I'm sorry, I agree. Kids shouldn't be suspended when they're in eighth grade and they can't read. Who the heck would want to go to school? You're not addressing the fundamental issues initially. And for the parents that can afford tutoring, these kids are going to be fine. But for the parents who can't afford tutoring, they're up a creek. And if you really want to educate everybody out there, go look up Kareem Weaver. He is a vice president of AACP Education Committee, and he did a documentary called The Right to Read. Educate yourself. This is the fundamental issue in our education system. And because of Fontenot and Pinnell, that the Democratic Party wanted to embrace and get rid of literacy funding in 2000, and I believe it was 17, that is the fundamental issue. It's all about money.
Well, thanks for the call, Dawn. I mean, good points. But something else about these dinners. I mean, what an indictment of the education system for people that probably did come from households where parents cared about their education and they had resources, maybe they had tutoring, whatever. But these are mostly college-educated honky women. So what's that an indictment of? It's not an indictment of not being able to read. So there are multiple viruses tearing through the body politic at the same time. Let's not conflate the two. Let's recognize all of them and treat them accordingly. By the way, text from 630, ask one of the black women if they'd like to trade places with a white HVAC installer. Yeah. I don't know. I think it's probably better business just getting the $5,000 check to sit around and call a bunch of honky women racist for a couple hours. Yeah, I don't think they're going to be in for the manual labor there. Tom in Schererville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture where the husbands are during this dinner. Are they in the garage hanging themselves from a rafter, or, I mean, sucking up car fumes? Where are they at?
Hopefully out with their buddies.
They're
off some steam.
They're looking for their penises, I believe.
Dan,
they're trying to find where their wife hid their penis. Right?
Okay.
Honey, have you seen? I mean, honestly,
how do you come home and tell your husband you went to a dinner like that?
How do you, if you're married to that, how do you come home? Well, when do you admit you've made a terrible mistake? But I mean, the problem, of course, is that a lot of these male impersonators they are married to.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just as bad. They're just as adult. These are not men. They're wearing pee hats at anti-Trump rallies, too.
They probably financed that $5,000 dinner.
I mean, do you know how weak? I mean, come on. Nobody but me has ever been to one of these soirees in these wealthy honky enclaves. Do you know how weak some of the men are? And I'm talking about successful men financially. You know how pathetic they are?
The last one I went to. Oh, this, I mean, he was such a pee hat. I wanted
exactly.
And he was almost shaking. He goes, you know what? It's easier to get a gun than an abortion in Illinois. I said, do you own a weapon?
And you said,
do you know
you
what
said,
it's? I'm
and
staring
said,
at him like, are you out of your mind?
Well, and you said, do you want an abortion that bad? What do you,
I did say, I'm like, you're looking to get an abortion. Are you pregnant?
Yeah.
And then I said, have you ever applied for a FOID card? Gun? I said, no. Do you know what the process is like? You don't go into a gun store and get a gun right away. I had to walk him through the process. And
the process. The process is not the point.
He was
disposition
is. He was shaking.
Yeah, I mean, you like the
right
success. These men.
They're not men.
These alleged professional men, mostly professional men. Some of you've got some union goons who vote Democrat and do the rough and tumble, phony act, but. But mostly it's these effete professional men that matriculated at the same schools as these ghastly offals. I mean, they're just as reprehensible. They're just as noxious. And I don't know why we're afraid to, especially men, man to man, put it between their eyes. What the hell's wrong with you? But we are. Doesn't happen near enough. Yeah, some people need to get straightened out. Men.
I stood my ground. Well, he was shaking like a kindergartner.
Rick in Downers Grove, quickly.
Hey, good morning. Hey, like you said earlier, it starts in high school, the brainwashing, continues in college. They come out, they have some money, and the smart ones are the black women fleecing these morons. They don't care about race. They just realize these people are stupid, and they're going to fall for this. Let's take some money from them.
Thanks for the call. The culture of deference that Chevy Steele has written so eloquently about. It's real. Read, as Dawn from Avery said, read and then observe and connect the two to understand.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
I mean, what are you thinking?
about, Jerry? Marriage? Family? Well, they're prisons. Man-made prisons. You're doing time. You get up in the morning, she's there. You go to sleep at night, she's there. It's like you gotta ask permission to use the bathroom.
Is it all right if I use the bathroom?
Really? Yeah, and you can forget about watching TV while you're eating.
I can?
Oh, yeah. You know why? Because it's dinner time. And you know what you do at dinner?
What? You talk about your day.
How was your day today? Did you have a good day today or a bad day today? Well, what kind of day was it?
Well, I don't know. How about you? How was your day?
Oh, it's sad, Jerry. It's a sad state of affairs.
We were talking about Race to Dinner before Mike Scott's newscast, and I got a good text, I think, encapsulates. We're talking about the men, too. Now, these ghastly white women who pay $5,000 to have someone come in and tell them they're racist so that they can be absolved of their sins and feel like they're good people when they kibitz at yoga class the next day. Text on this, 630, about the men, the men that they're married to, these male impersonators. Small penises and flashy cars and half good looking women that they fell for, probably had a kid or two, and they don't want to give up anything. So they go with the program and they're ballless, useless, worthless men, just as useless as their women. That's a good summation. Yeah. Good summation of the problem.
Sums it up pretty well.
Yeah. And of course, that infects the political culture. And it also is reflected in our political leadership of the city, of the county, of the state. It's a lot of ballness going around, that is to say. Where there are balls is where they shouldn't be, like between Lori Lightfoot's legs, you remember.
Hey, oh, she is the biggest you-know-what in all of the city.
I've heard. And the village of Dalton's about to find out, aren't they? Mm-hmm. On this matter of the police-involved shooting of Dexter Reed that we're returning to, we talked about it a bit earlier in the program. This is going where you would expect it to go. After Adam Toledo's police-involved shooting where Adam Toledo was killed after brandishing a weapon, well, after firing the weapon, then running away from police and then turning with a weapon, he was shot and killed. It was a good shoot, even though it's a tragic occurrence, just like this was a good shoot, Reed, even though it's a tragic occurrence. So that led to calls to end foot chases. And now we have calls to end tactical units because foot chases are racist, endanger the populace. Now everything that is associated with an event where people don't like the outcome because people don't like the police. I'm talking about people in power. Where to then further hamstring police to the detriment of the law-abiding. And that seems to be where this is going to go. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by John Garrido, former Chicago Police Lieutenant, 16th District, president of the Garrido Stray Rescue Foundation, GarridoStrayRescue.org as well. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you for having me again.
So, I mean, it's just your reaction not only to the specifics of the incident, as we have seen through the body camera footage of all the officers that were present, but also the fallout over the last couple of days in terms of what the trial lawyers representing the family had to say, what COPA has had to say, what politicians are saying. What's your sort of summation at present?
Well, like you said, anytime there's a loss of life, it's tragic. But the Monday morning quarterbacking and second guessing, started right out of the gates, even just starting with the mayor and his comments, not acknowledging that the officer, that we actually had an officer shot, that this incident could, like so many other ones, could have easily been avoided. All he had to do was comply. All he had to do was roll the window down, open the door, get out of the car, and everything. He would live another day to tell stories about how the police somehow violated his rights. But what he did is he made a choice. He had a gun in the car, and this is just my theory on it. He was arrested back in July of last year. He had a case pending for being in possession of a loaded firearm that he tried to bring into a festival. He was in court, or supposed to be in court, 2 weeks prior to this incident. So now he's out driving around again, and now he's got a gun in the car. The police put a stop on him. You know he doesn't want to go back to jail. That's got to be going through his mind. He's got a loaded gun in the car. And instead of just getting out and just dealing with the consequences, he picked up his gun and he decided to fire. I totally fired at least 11 times from inside the car. He attempted to murder those police officers. His intentions were clear. And then this whole incident occurs within a couple minutes. And everybody wants to come in now. Well, was the traffic stop legit? Should they have even stopped him at all? Why are we, you know, how does a and that's what I like to tie it to. How does a traffic stop end in death? Well, it's not the traffic stop that ended in death. It's him trying to kill police officers that ended in his death.
Good point.
And that's exactly where it comes down to. They keep wanting to go back to, well, you know, how does a traffic stop end in death? Because he picked up his gun and he shot at the police. Right. Everybody's got to know that's going to be the end result.
Wait, John, I'm sorry. You said 2 weeks prior to this, did he go to his court hearing or did he blow it off?
I don't know. That I don't know yet. I don't know. I just know that 2 weeks prior he had a court date. I don't know if he actually went or not.
Okay, now these four officers are saying that one of the four shot at Reed three times as he was laying motionless on the ground. Do you know anything more about that? I mean, the video shows him he was still moving while they handcuffed him.
Yeah, well, he was also still moving when he went down on the ground. So you've got a situation where this guy, he fired first. He starts shooting at the officers. Now you're in the heat of battle, right? He tries to drive the vehicle away. He crashes into the car in front of him. And then he gets out of the car. He's coming out of the car. You can't see his hands when he's initially coming out. They're supposed to, but they are firing until they stop the threat. Well, this guy made his intentions clear. He's firing at the police. He comes out of the car. They are going to continue to fire until he's neutralized, until he stops. When he goes down, unfortunate for him, the way he goes down with his hand under his body in a way that they can't see what he's doing and if he still has that gun or not. And it happens within seconds. It's not like they chased him a half a block down and then continue to fire on him. This is all immediate, right there, out of the car.
So we should, but that's, nobody's interested in that. It's the other things. It's let's talk about traffic stops. We need to eliminate. And by the way, there's legislation in Springfield bouncing around. We need to eliminate pretextual stops. Right. There's no reason to stop anybody for a seatbelt violation. No reason to stop anybody for expired plates because it's done in a racist way, and so the best way to eliminate that manifestation of racism is to eliminate those traffic stops.
Yeah, just completely eliminate proactive law enforcement, proactive policing altogether. We're not going to chase anybody on foot or by vehicle. We're not going to do any traffic stops for any, you know, quote-unquote minor violations. But then at the same time, hold the police accountable because they're not getting guns off the street and because they're not damping down crime. You have to allow the police to do what they're supposed to do, and that's to enforce law and order. And as long as you're going to eliminate all that, well, then this is what you're going to get. You're going to end up with high crime. You're going to end up with all these burglaries and robberies. You're going to end up with guys like this driving around with guns in the car because they know they're not going to get stopped. All they have to do is just not do anything super crazy.
The other problem, in addition to the stop itself, the other problem is the tactical unit was the tactical officers were mean. They were loud. They were yelling, which is not nice. And they also had guns drawn, and so they were very menacing. And it's understandable that somebody would be afraid, and thus it's somehow understandable that that person who was afraid would open fire on four police officers.
Yeah. So when they come out of the car, for officer safety, you want to get the person to comply, right? You want to make sure that everybody's safe, right? So they tell him to roll the window down. He rolls the window down, and he's just staring at the officer. He's not talking. He's not saying anything. He's just staring at the officer, and then he starts to roll the window up. Well, the first thought, okay, what are his intentions? Why is he now not complying? Obviously, something is wrong here. And so they're going to raise their voices. They're going to, you know, things will start to I guess they say, is escalate, right? They're going to try to get him to comply, get him to unlock the door. Yeah, of course guns are going to come out because we don't know what he's doing. We don't know what he's up to. And as that window starts to go up, then all of a sudden he starts shooting. So their thoughts were correct. He was up to no good, and he ended up shooting at the police and shooting one officer.
Well, and the family's attorney maintains that they didn't identify, didn't identify themselves as police officers, so that he might have been scared when they approached his car.
Oh, right. He thought they were. He thought they were gangster disciples.
Just you took the words out of my mouth. Yeah, they looked like a few gangbangers driving around in a police car that pulled them over with a siren, and they were all dressed in police gear.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
grabbing at straws. They're looking there. Look, at the end of the day, they're looking for a payday.
And they're going to get it.
Absolutely. I'm sure. I wouldn't doubt it.
What do we know more about Dexter Reed? I mean, I found out that he did go to Westinghouse. He graduated in 2016. He was on the basketball team.
The
they took him to a regional championship, but that was, 8 years ago. And the family said that he had aspirations to start his own clothing company and maybe become a sports broadcaster. But says that he has
Costanza.
A job.
Yeah. Okay.
Broadcasting. Yeah. Right. Everybody has lots of thoughts and ideas of what they're going to do. And that's why all this stuff comes up. You know, we get the traditional cap and gown picture that comes out.
Yeah.
They'll reach back all the way, 8 years ago to come up with things about him. And he might have been, on a good track at one time. But clearly that's not where it's gone. You know, he was out carrying a gun last year in July. And then now here he is driving around again with a gun. What he's up to? Don't know what his intentions are. Don't know.
He
drives around because he's but that's what it comes down to all day long. He fired at the police 11 times at least. They found at least 11 casings inside of his vehicle. So it wasn't just, I'm going to let around go and hope the police are going to run away from me and back up and get out of here to scare, quote unquote, scare them away. He was trying to kill police officers.
Do you think the tactical unit knew who he was?
I 100% don't know. I have no idea. From watching the videos and things, I don't know. I'm not sure.
But, I mean, because it's one of those things where, give us more color on the tactical units. Because, I mean, the areas they patrol, they know who the gangbangers are. I mean, there's a level of, sophistication here in terms of intel from experience and the work product of generations of police. You know who the gangs are, how they operate, who the old players are, who the new players are. And I'm not saying he was in a gang. I don't know. But I'm just and if you're in a specific area, then you get to know that landscape pretty well, don't you? So you sort of know who the bad guys are, because most of the people in these neighborhoods are good guys. I mean, they're law abiding. And so the bad guys are relatively easy to pick out based on their conduct.
That's absolutely correct. They definitely, and that's what you want. You want your tag teams to be in tune with the neighborhood, with the community, to know what's going on and to know who the bad actors are. And you want them out there. You want them to be out there doing proactive policing. You want them to out there doing these stops. You want them getting the guns off the street, getting the drugs off the street. That's what you want your tag teams to do. And these officers, they were definitely going somewhere to do something, and it looks like they put a stop on this guy. Whether they knew who he was or not, I don't think I heard in any of the videos. They didn't never say his name or anything like that, so I don't know if they knew him prior to that, who he was. But I don't know, maybe the vehicle was involved in something previously and they recognized it. I'm not sure.
So that'll all come out at some point. But the larger issue, though, about these tactical units, we heard from Sheila Betty, who is legal clinician at Northwestern University Law School. It's Northwestern now we're talking about, John, so mind your manners. She said that tactical units are essentially hit squads. They are hunting for prey, and that's what happened on that fateful day that Dexter Reed was shot. You had a unit that was hunting, and Dexter Reed was their prey.
Oh, my God. The inflammatory stuff that people put out there, and then they wonder why when we have, rioting and we have things go up for grabs later on. I mean, even just look at the headlines of half of these articles and things that come up. It's ridiculous. Obviously, they're not hunters. So, their job is to go out there and to keep the community safe by enforcing the law and making arrests and eliminating crime. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to be out there working, and yeah, they're out there looking for bad guys. That's what they're out there doing. Nobody's hunting hit squads. I don't know what the stats are as far as the number of officer-involved shootings that are specific to tactical officers, but I don't know that they're any higher than anybody else and the uniformed officers.
I got to ask you this question about FOP, because we sort of had the same conversation about Jonathan Jackson after he slimed white Chicago firefighters, saying last week that they let buildings in black neighborhoods burn because they're upset that black residents force them out of the neighborhoods in which they used to live, and they just don't care about black neighborhoods, whereas in white neighborhoods, they save lives and save property. The Firefighters Union responded by rescinding their endorsement of Jonathan Jackson, rescinding an endorsement they conferred on Jonathan Jackson. Why would they do that was my question.
Right.
I mean, why would they endorse him in the first place? So here's
right.
the thing. Looking at FOP's D2s, the PAC for FOP, the D2s, Friends of Justin Slaughter got $10,000 from FOP. And so did other Justin Slaughter was the lead sponsor on the Safety Act, the Pritzker Purge Law. And so did other Dem state legislators who are defund the police, decarceration, deprosecution type Democrats. And then I see this from my old friend Dave Sullivan, who was a state legislator from Park Ridge for a time and is a lobbyist now. This in the Lodge 7 FOP legislative report. We're seeing bipartisan support for our renewed efforts to work with the legislature, and our bridge building with some legislators who have not always voted the way FOP wants is showing great progress as well. The pension COLA bill for Chicago police officers now has bipartisan sponsorship. The lead sponsors in both the House and the Senate voted for the Safety Act. The House, it's Justin Slaughter, the guy who just got 10 grand. And in the Senate, it's that guy who looks like 20 pounds of manure stuffed into a 10-pound bag, Bob Martwick, on the northwest side there. And so I guess my question is, why should I look at this and not say, oh, I see, lawlessness on the streets of Chicago and statewide instituted by politicians like Slaughter and Martwick. But as long as we get our COLA bump, we'll sell out the city, the state, and our own officers for 30 pieces of silver.
Well, there's lots of reasons I imagine that they endorse who they endorse. I myself have had disagreements many, many, many times and discussions with different regimes that have come through FOP. In regard to who they support and who they don't support. There is a fairly large committee. They do discuss it. They interview all the candidates. It doesn't make sense sometimes. A lot of times it doesn't make sense. I can't explain it. It doesn't make any sense. On its surface, you're right, it doesn't look good. But I don't know why they would support somebody who actually supported, was actually one of the lead legislators in the Safety Act.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and especially, I mean, not only just support, but actually give them money.
It's really something. I mean, it's frustrating because, you know, you want to be on the side of people doing important work like police and fire and even government workers. But it's tough when they're not on your side, too. And that's what I feel about these public sector unions, including the police and fire often. Very frustrating. John Garrido.
The union is out there to, support people who are going to support the interests of their members, and sometimes that, you know, just any unions, that's not always going to, you know, coincide with what the community thinks. But remember, the members themselves, that's who we support. We support our officers, and our officers are out there working every day, putting their lives on the line for us and the community, regardless of what any of the unions do. It's still, we always want to support our police officers.
Well, I agree, but, you know, you'd like some better alignment from the union, the official union's conduct oftentimes.
Yeah,
John Garrido, former Chicago police lieutenant, 16th District, president also of the Garrido Stray Rescue Foundation, if you're looking for a pup or you're aiming, you're looking for another cat. GarridoStrayRescue.org, GarridoStrayRescue.org. John, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Good talk.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. If you'll indulge me, I want to read a little excerpt from a commentary I penned that we'll post at American Greatness Today, where I podcast, on Trump and his statement earlier this week on abortion. So first, Trump left office after exhausting his appeals to the legislative and judicial branches. Now Trump is deferring to the will of the people of the several states as expressed through their duly elected state officials when it comes to the legal treatment of abortion in post-Roe America. Trump is the strangest of all iterations of tyrants, one who believes in federalism, as he acknowledged when he invoked the Bill of Rights, the 10th Amendment specifically, in response to criticisms from some pro-lifers of his position. It's unusual for a dictator to concede limits to his power. But Trump's position on abortion is simply a political compromise in order to advance his electoral chances in November, right? Yeah, perhaps. So in other words, he is tailoring his view on abortion to secure the votes he need from the people to win an election fairly. Again, it's quite the reluctant dictator who seeks the consent of the governed. I say this, just you know, that excerpt, I mean, just because of the Trump, the tyrant, Trump, the tyrant who won't dictate to the people on abortion, whereas the left is all for federalizing, centralizing the issue and dictating to the country. And I'm sorry, who's the tyrant again? Whereas Trump is pushing back against sort of an open-ended commitment to the surveillance state per his pushing some House Republicans to vote against Section 702 reauthorization under FISA and reminding people of the FISA abuses that directly impacted him. And I would add the FISA abuses that have been documented and conceded by Christopher Wray and the FBI in terms of illegal searches of Americans, abuses there. So and it's the left and the Wall Street Journal editorial board that suggests anybody who doesn't essentially write these blank checks to agencies that have disgraced themselves, like the FBI, have demonstrated that they are terribly politicized, they're the threats to democracy, to a free society. Right? Trump, he's that threat to a free society. Just remarkable, particularly since he's a known quantity. You may remember he was president for 4 years. It wasn't that long ago, but people have short memories. I mean, incredibly short memories. I think conveniently short memories. I've said this many times. All the bloviations and cringeworthy rhetorical moments aside, terribly conventional politician when it comes to the actual give and take of politics. And there are some real authoritarian threats afoot. And one was documented thanks to Elon Musk and the reporters he entrusted to tell the story, like Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger and others. The Twitter files. This is the subject of the Murthy v. Missouri case pending before the Supreme Court. And the government, the federal government, their unconstitutional use of cutouts to suppress speech through third-party social media platforms that they couldn't suppress directly themselves. And now we see the same thing happening in Brazil. And the only reason it's there's a fight is because Elon Musk owns X. Because otherwise, these other social media companies, as we saw in this country, go along to get along because, well, it's nice to have the federal government backing your play when you need them. If you're a global company.
Yeah, it's their coworkers.
And so where do things stand in Brazil with Elon Musk, and what exactly is the involvement, if any, because it's been alleged, of those same censorious agencies in our government that have meddled in the last several elections in this country? Here's what Elon Musk's latest report is from Brazil in terms of what they're threatening if he doesn't comply.
They have threatened to cut off X entirely from Brazil. They've also threatened to arrest our employees, and they have applied a $20,000 a day fine.
But Bolsonaro, the previous president that was ousted in sort of in similar fashion to Trump, curiously, he was the real threat to some sort of small D democratic form of government in Brazil, not Lula in that Supreme Court that is putting the arm on X. This is not an endorsement of everything Bolsonaro said and did, nor is it an endorsement of everything that Trump said and did. It's just a description of the landscape and who has behaved in a way that should be more pause for concern. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Professor Daniel Klines, professor of economics at George Mason University, author of Misinformation is a Word We Use to Shut You Up. Yes. Professor Klein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
So what about that situation in Brazil and any comments you have to the extent you'd like on whether or not there are American fingerprints on what is happening at the Brazilian government is attempting to do to X?
I think you described the situation well, and I think what's happening in Brazil is happening, well, I wouldn't say everywhere, but here in America, obviously in a lot of countries like Canada and Europe. The censorship, I think, is the other side of the propaganda. You need to see this whole tyrannical effort as involving those two things necessarily. So without the censorship, the propaganda, the big lies, would be ripped to shreds. So it's very important that they censor the people who would dissent from, criticize, expose the big lies. And that seems to be what these people are about. I think they have CCP envy. I think they envy the CCP for being able to weaponize everything to basically criminalize the opposition and achieve one-party authoritarian rule. I think that's the dream of the left, whether they kind of consciously realize it or not. I'm not talking about the Democrat next door. I'm talking about the leaders, as it were, of what is now the Democrat operation.
Well, to believe that they don't realize it is to say that they are just so committed. They are just so confident about the righteousness of their cause that they haven't even contemplated that in a free society you're supposed to allow dissenting opinions, and I should be confident enough in my my belief system, my argument, that I'll persuade people to my view of things because that's how it works. This is like sort of like a grade school civics lesson about living in a free society and about our representative republic. So it's just it's strains the bounds of credulity, I guess, for me to believe that they don't understand the implications of what they're doing.
They seem to get the signals of what to be doing and saying and enforcing from above, as it were. And they just, don't think critically about it and don't realize the hypocrisy and inconsistency of what they're saying and doing with respect to things they otherwise or just, a few years ago would say, for example, about free speech. I don't think they are. I think most of them are not well aware of how bad what they're doing is. And they delude themselves. So I agree that there's a great deal of self-deceit, delusion involved. And misinformation, the word, their use of the word misinformation is a stratagem to put across the censorship because it misrepresents what it is they're really objecting to. What they're objecting to is not properly called misinformation. It would be more apt for them to say that they are opposing wrongthink, okay? Yeah. Things that they don't like. And it's not proper to put it, to express it as an informational matter. Information is a narrow part of knowledge. It's a narrow dimension of knowledge. The wider dimensions are interpretation, judgment, and it's in those wider dimensions where the objection actually lies. Like I say, it's really the broader concept of something like wrongthink that they're feeling. They don't like, you know, someone says the virus came from a lab, and they say that's misinformation to say that the virus came from a lab, or they used to. And it's not an informational matter. Information is a flatter notion in epistemics and in normal language. Like when we're misinformed, we're ready to admit the correction. Like if I go into the supermarket and I ask the clerk, where's the peanut butter? And he says it's in aisle 6. And I go to aisle 6 and I don't find it. I look around, I find it in aisle 9. He misinformed me. And I say, hey, I found it. It was in aisle 9. He says, oh, sorry about that. That's what misinformation is. So it's really about, they're putting across their censorship by representing the people that they are censoring as committing simple falsehoods, so cut and dried falsehoods. And, you know, we all oppose cut and dried falsehoods, right? And so that makes it look kind of innocent on the censor's part, like to shut up people who are making cut and dried falsehoods. But it's not cut and dried falsehoods. What they're actually censoring is larger issues of judgment about who to trust, whose interpretations to take seriously, what to make of the situation. And that's what free speech and a free society is about, for us to sort through different points of view, different interpretations, and judgments over interpretations. So the misinformation label they use is a strategy to censor.
Well, shouldn't certain things be censored on social media? I'm like, remember the Tide Pod Challenge? And in your article in the Wall Street Journal, you talked about Supreme Court Justice KBJ, Katina Brown Jackson, about a hypothetical that she proposed about a teen challenge where it involved teens jumping out of windows.
I'm not saying that the government shouldn't take steps to maybe try to suppress certain things. My objection is that the justice there called it this information. I think she should say this content, this material, these images, these videos, because it's not just like what people jumping out of windows. What is the information? What informational content is there in the video which valorizes jumping out of windows? That it's cool? Like suppose you take it as saying, it's cool to jump out of third floor windows. That's not an informational matter. It's a larger matter of interpretation, judgment, aesthetics, even, like what's cool, right? And so it's just wrong to kind of call it information as the justice did. And that's all part of this stratagem on their part to make it look like what they're doing is innocent. We just want to rid the world of these cut and dried mistruths, misinformation. Mm-hmm. When really what they're doing is they're censoring what they don't like. You see?
Yeah.
So it's no, not that's... that I don't want to say the government should never do something or that or whatever. The point is that we got to be on to this misinformation stratagem. It's a censorship stratagem.
Right, because it's a catch-all. Yeah, you're right. You just throw everything that, as you said, you just throw everything that you don't like, you don't want to hear, you don't want other people to hear, because it's a dangerous word or a dangerous idea, into the misinformation bucket, and it's nice and clean that way.
The honest way for them to do it is, what you say is wrong. Think we think it's bad. We're shutting you up. And if they were honest that way, you know, it would be obvious that they're just censoring different judgments about the world.
Yeah, too obvious, which is why they're not that straightforward about it. Professor Daniel Klein, professor of economics, George Mason University, author of Misinformation is a Word We Use to Shut You Up. Professor Klein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Can the Chinese Communist Party simultaneously be the greatest national security threat to the United States and also a party and thus a country in decline? That seems to be what our next guest argues. He is Stephen Mosher. He's the president of the Population Research Institute. He's an expert on China dating back some 40 years from an academic perspective. He's also the author of the recently released book, I think it's his 10th, on China, The Devil in Communist China, From Mao Down to Xi. The Devil in Communist China, From Mao Down to Xi, is the book. I had the occasion to record a podcast with Stephen Mosher that will be available next week for a more wide-ranging conversation on China. He's very, very knowledgeable, really interesting. We covered a lot of ground, and we'll try to cover as much as we can here as well. Stephen Mosher, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, it's good to be here with you, Dan and Amy.
So explain that seeming dichotomy. It's an existential threat to the United States. We've got a select committee that was chaired by Representative Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin on the Chinese Communist Party. And at the same time, it is a party and thus a country in decline. And so how should we understand what our posture should be?
Well, I mean, China had a good run, but it's now over. I mean, the demographic collapse is ongoing. They eliminated 400 million unborn children in the one-child policy, which ran for 36 years. Those workers, women, those men who would have created families and had children of their own, they're gone. And China's population is aging and dying more rapidly than any human population has ever aged and died. So that's strike one. Strike two is they've overbuilt. I mean, my goodness, they've got 65 million empty apartments. They've got ghost cities all over the country because they overbuilt. They've got empty shopping malls. They've got half-constructed high-rise apartment buildings. And they've got tens of millions of people who invested their life savings into those projects only to find the companies that were supposedly building those apartments and retail outlets have gone bankrupt. The money is gone. And then, of course, you've got the best evidence that China's on the decline is you've got tens of thousands of people from China crossing illegally our southern border. I mean, over the last 12 months, about 40,000 from China. The numbers are staggeringly increased over the last couple of years. So there's a huge pool of money and people desperate to get out of China because it's a country in decline. That doesn't mean it's any less dangerous. Mm-hmm. That may, in fact, make it more dangerous. I mean, Xi Jinping, with his back against the wall domestically, might seek a foreign adventure. In fact, he seems to be doing just that with vis-a-vis Japan and Taiwan and the South China Sea, the Philippines right now.
And so when I'm sure when people that work for multinational corporations that may have a presence in China, big manufacturers, social media companies, car makers, Elon Musk, when they hear that, they're probably having a tough time reconciling that, too. Do you think that corporate America appreciates where China is and maybe where their interests lie? I mean, to say changing the distribution of their resources and supply lines out of China more quickly than has been done up to this point?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Dan, because you saw that begin under President Trump in 2017, 2018, with the first round of the tariffs. Now, a company like Apple, headed by Tim Cook, or like Tesla, headed by Elon Musk, which has huge investments in China, is basically hostage to the regime. I mean, what are they going to do? They don't want to shut down their factory. They don't want to alienate the Chinese Communist Party leader, Xi Jinping, because he could shut them out of the domestic market overnight. Basically, they could regulate Tesla in China out of existence, Apple Watches and iPods and all the rest out of existence in China. That's why when Xi Jinping came to San Francisco, these guys were all there to dinner, clapping for him, paying $40,000 a seat. They want to stay on the good side of the dictator because he can close them out of the domestic market overnight. So, so they're captive. They're captive. They've got too much money invested in China. There's no way to get it out. By the way, currency transfers out of China are very difficult. So they're stuck. Quite frankly.
Well, how did the Trump tariffs in 2018, you know, still in place today, set China back on its heels?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Amy. This was a partial compensation, the Trump tariffs, for the subsidies that the Communist Party provides to export industries. You know, China has two economies. It has, along the coast, it has the export sector of the economy, which is the only economy that really works according to market principles and makes money. The rest of the economy is in the doldrums. It's largely dominated by state-owned enterprises, which are white elephants that require huge state subsidies every year. And China cheats on currency. It cheats on trade. It sells goods sometimes at below the cost of manufacturing them. What do you do to compensate for that? So what do you do to allow a level playing field for not free trade, but for fair trade to keep American workers employed? Well, you put tariffs on Chinese goods. The tariffs actually need to be raised. And I'd like to see 10% tariffs across the board. But we've already seen a relocation of factories back to the United States, to Mexico, to Canada, to India, the countries that respect our values and institutions, rather than a country that, quite frankly, is headed by a communist party that wants to destroy us.
Well, so if the recommendation is to go after China's export economy to further cripple the regime, then... you know, don't you fear, and wouldn't Tim Cook and Elon Musk fear, that one easy path to retribution is to, you know, punish those American-based global companies like Apple and Tesla? It seems to me that a choice that has to be made is that a policy choice you're going to make and risk that and risk the repercussions in the domestic market, because something's got to give here, right?
Well, you really do have to protect the manufacturing base of the United States. You know, economic nationalism is national security. You've got to be able to make things in the United States, and you can't source, you can't build ships and planes and tanks and other things to defend the country if you're dependent upon component parts to come from your principal adversary in the world. That makes no sense. What's going to happen in the event of a conflict? You're not going to be able to access those component parts. So you've got to decouple from China. I don't think there's any way to manage the relationship so that we can live peacefully together. That's been the dream for the last 40 years. I've lived through it for the last 40 years. I was the first American social scientist in China back in 1979, 1980. We all hoped that China was going our way. It didn't happen. They are now reverting to type. They are still a one-party dictatorship headed down the socialist road to ruin. And they still desire and hunger to dominate larger parts of the world and to replace the United States as the dominant power in the world. That is simply a fact, however much we wish it weren't so. And so we've got to deal with the reality that China believes that this is a you live, you die scenario. That's how you say it in Chinese, a fight to the death, Ni Su Wo Huo in Chinese. So, you know, we've got to recognize that reality and decouple. Let's have closer economic ties to our allies in Asia, Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, India. Let's bring industry back to the United States and open some of those 70,000 factories that were shuttered because China cheats on trade and manipulates its currency and subsidizes exports. I think that would be good for America. It'd certainly be good for American workers. Let's bring the Rust Belt back to life.
We've talked too about, of course, China's influence in international institutions. Let's talk about the World Health Organization as an obvious example, particularly because of the ravages of COVID response, the policies in response to the COVID virus. And now we have some talk emanating from China about avian flu again.
Oh boy.
And I wonder about. This is not a conspiracy. It's a question. Disease warfare, whether however, I think it's pretty more likely than not that the virus emanated, the COVID virus emanated from that Wuhan virology lab. But regardless of whether it did or it didn't, China's handling of it with respect to the rest of the world was not exactly honorable. And maybe it was incompetence, maybe it was purposeful, maybe it's a combination of the two. But what about that scenario replaying itself with another virus? And maybe particularly if China is nearing the death throes, as you suggest, maybe more purposeful, if that's possible, this time around.
Well, Dan, you know, I've written a book about pandemics in world history, and it turns out that since the Chinese Communist Party took power in China, they have actually released 4 pandemics on the world. The first was the Asian flu, 1957, 1958, the Hong Kong flu, 67, 68, SARS-1 back in 2003, and then, of course, COVID in 2020. And the reason I say they released it on the world is the first three of those were what's called zoonotic. I mean, they came from nature. Clearly, it was a virus that passed from nature into a human being in China and then spread in China. Why do I say they spread it throughout the world? I've said this in print, by the way, in the New York Post and other outlets last year. I say that because they knew they had a dangerous new virus on the loose. They knew they had an epidemic in China. They did not, in 1957-58, tell the World Health Organization or the world. They did not, in 67-68, with the Hong Kong flu, tell the World Health Organization or the world. They did not, in 2003, tell us about SARS-1, which could have been much more deadly than the coronavirus epidemic. But fortunately, our Canadian neighbors, Canadian intelligence, caught intelligence intercepts in China about a dangerous new pathogen on the loose. And we confronted Beijing officials, and they said, "Oh yeah, we've got mm-hmm. this disease down in southern mm-hmm. China, which is killing 12% of the people it infects. 12%. So this is a pattern, Dan. This is not the first time they have deliberately released a virus on the world. So I think it's quite deliberate. And by the way, I said in February, very early on, and got canceled for it, February of 2020, that all roads led to the Wuhan lab. And nothing I've learned in the years since has convinced me otherwise.
What is the stability of the dictator, the top dictator there, since they're all part of a dictatorial class? I'm talking about Xi, of course. What is his stability as the autocrat, the head of the Communist Party and thus the country? Is there, it's sort of the same conversation we have about Putin. Is there any sort of palace intrigue where he could be deposed, popular uprising or something else that would change the trajectory of China?
Well, I mean, there's always palace intrigue in China. I mean, the infighting within the top ranks of the Chinese Communist Party is unimaginably brutal, and often results in imprisonment of offending parties. So what you have in China today is a person modeling himself on Chairman Mao Zedong, who was basically, by the end of his life, by the end of the Cultural Revolution, the absolute dictator of China. He was also megalomaniac, and in his final years, he was paranoid. So paranoid, in fact, that he had his principal rivals in the party killed by the Red Guards. And even his chief supporter, Zhou Enlai, he let die of cancer because he forbid the doctors to treat Zhou Enlai, who had been his premier for decades, his right-hand man, for bladder cancer, and let it spread throughout his intestines and eventually kill him in great pain. Why did he do that? Because he feared the rise of a rival, even among his friends. We see the same behavior on the part of Xi Jinping. A few months ago, there was a party congress, and Xi Jinping's one supporter among the top ranks of the Chinese Communist Party for the last 15 years was the former president, Hu Jintao. President Hu had backed Xi Jinping from the beginning. It's why Xi Jinping is the head of China today, because he had the backing from Hu Jintao and his faction. And what happened during the last party congress? Hu Jintao was lifted out of his seat by the head of Xi Jinping's security force and taken out of the room. Why? Because he complained about the fact that his faction had not been given any seats on the Politburo, and apparently an agreement he had with Xi Jinping was violated. Anyway, the internecine warfare, the warfare between the factions, came out in the open. And the last faction, aside from Xi Jinping's, was publicly humiliated in front of 400 members of the Central Committee and alternate members of the Central Committee. Xi Jinping has an absolute grasp on power today in China. He's known as the chairman of everything. He's the chairman of the military commission. He's the head of the government. He's the head of the party. He's the head of all these other groups that have been set up in the government. He sidelined the premier, the number two guy, doesn't even come out in public anymore. He's probably afraid to say anything or do anything because Xi Jinping will see him as a rival and have him removed as well.
That was removed, what happened to him?
Well, he was said to have had health problems. Bet he did.
Yeah.
How convenient. Yeah. You have a health problem now, buddy.
But so what you're saying, so she is the chairman of everything. So he's sort of like to the Chinese Communist Party or to China what Larry Fink is to corporate America. I got it. Now that makes sense. So this is going to get, in terms of the Chinese Communist Party, this is going to get more contentious and uglier before and if it ever gets better.
Well, it is, and because Xi Jinping had a successor when he took office, someone who's being groomed to take over the presidency in 2023. Well, that didn't happen. He had that guy charged with corruption years ago, and he's spending the rest of his life in prison. So there's no successor, and all of the other factions have been destroyed, and so it's only Xi Jinping's faction at the top of the power pyramid in China. What happens when Xi Jinping dies? There's going to be a vicious power struggle among his own subordinates, the people he trusted. And we don't know how that's going to turn out. We also know that there are demographic problems, economic problems, problems with the export sector, the economy. So all of this is coming to a head. And, whither China? We don't know.
Stephen Mosher, president of the Population Research Institute. He's an expert on China, as you've heard. He's the author of the recently released book, The Devil and Communist China, From Mao Down to Xi. Stephen Mosher, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Dan and Amy.
Yeah, thank you. Very informative, and we'll have you back. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump had some comments on the... it's gone beyond the middling of the issue between Israel and Hamas by the Biden administration to pretty outright antagonism by the administration in the direction of Bibi and Israel in its prosecution of the campaign against the terrorist organization known as Hamas and other terrorist allies, including state sponsors of terror like Iran. You have top Democrat socialists like Pocahontas saying that Israel is guilty of genocide. You had to have the Secretary of Defense at a committee hearing this week say he sees no evidence that Israel is guilty of genocide. But nonetheless, he's being pushed on the issue by his party to make such a declaration as Elizabeth Warren did. Here's what President Trump had to say about this administration's turn against Israel.
Biden has totally lost control of the Israel situation. He has abandoned Israel. He's totally abandoned Israel. And frankly, he's a low IQ individual. He has no idea where he is and who he's supporting. He doesn't know if he's supporting the Palestinians, but he knows one thing. He is not supporting Israel. He has abandoned Israel. And any Jewish person that votes for a Democrat or votes for Biden should have their head examined.
Any Jewish person who votes for a Democrat or Biden should have their head examined. Difficult to disagree with that, actually.
Well, it just reminds me of when Biden said, if you vote for Trump, you ain't black.
He's not saying they're not Jewish. Okay. He's saying they should have their head examined.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think they're distinguishable, and I don't disagree. I would say the same thing. I would say anybody who votes for any of these Democrats who purport to represent you should have their head examined, unless you're some wealthy, overeducated, Wall Street financier or C-suite executive, because that's who they represent. You know, the academy, you know, the cultural institutions, the upper reaches of those cultural, civic and corporate institutions. But in terms of anybody else, I'd say the same thing writ large. Absolutely agree. And that's why I find it curious, some of the criticism coming from places like Tucker Carlson, actually, when it comes to assertions that somehow the state of Israel doesn't treat Christians particularly well. We've heard this from some other less informed places on the right, like Candace Owens. That didn't surprise me. You know, there's a lot of people on the right that don't know very much, unfortunately, as well. But it was a little bit more disconcerting coming from Tucker. And Victor Davis Hanson, I'll cede my time to him. He was on recently with Megyn Kelly on her podcast. My podcast is substantially better than Megyn Kelly's, but I'm not as pretty.
Oh, come on. You're comparing yourself to Megyn Kelly. You gotta wear just like a tank top.
Yeah,
she lets
exactly.
The arms show, if you know. Right, it's a gun show, Dan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I got to do. Anyway, VDH took up this issue of these criticisms from the right or the center right in the direction of Israel per the alleged mistreatment of Christians. And I think he dispatched that assertion quite nicely. Take a listen.
Christians themselves, not their spokesmen who have to. The problem we have when we have Christians in the Middle East that are living in the under in Gaza, or, and there's not many, they've been ethnically cleansed from Gaza, most of them. But if they're speaking in Syria or they're speaking in the Palestinian Authority, they're terrified. And everything they say is monitored. So mostly the Christians are very anti-Israel, the spokespeople. But when you look at actual events on the ground, they have fled. They either go to Europe or mostly to America or Israel. I think Israel's getting close to having 200,000 Christians. And they're not people who were there in 1947 necessarily. Most of them came to Israel as a refuge from religious persecution by Muslim governments. And I think most of the evangelical community that I know of is still very pro-Israel. I think what we're talking about is the libertarian right intellectual movement. And I understand, you know, I know that Tucker Carlson has voiced some things. Candace Owens has. The Cato Institute's been really vocal. There's some people on that website who've called for breaking relations almost with Israel. But I don't think it represents most Christians, much less most Americans. But I don't know quite what their arguments, because I've seen so many of them, you know. It doesn't take a lot of brains to say there's 500 million people in the Middle East and there's 12 million that live on a democratic government. And that is the only democratic constitutional system there. And when you go to Haifa or Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, and I have been to every Arab country in the Middle East, and you go to, except Emirates, I haven't been there, but if you go to Tunis or you go to Tripoli, or you go to Cairo, and these are moderate countries. You go to Jordan, you go to Baghdad, you go to Beirut, you go to Damascus, and then just compare it going to Haifa, for example. And it's just night and day. None of these people who are saying death to America, if they dared to go back into their own countries and they said death to Assad or death to the Palestinian or death to Hamas, they would be killed or they'd be in jail. But they wouldn't, if you're in Israel and you say death to Netanyahu, you're not. And so it's not Muslim Christian, it's just an empirical difference between a free society that lives by the rule of law and its neighbors who do most for the vast majority do not.
Yeah, I appreciate the reset from VDH to remember who our friends are, flaws and all, and who our enemies are. Flaws and only the Islamofascists. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Jonathan Tobin, editor-in-chief of Jewish News Syndicate. Jonathan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Good morning. And it's a tough act to follow Victor Davis Hanson, but I'll do my best.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, sort of respond the same way that he did in terms of sort of the larger geopolitical landscape on which this is all occurring. And let's sort of remember, you know, who we're talking about on both sides of the divide.
Yeah, I mean, he's completely right that the overwhelming majority of American Christians and certainly of evangelicals are pro-Israel. That's no doubt. They're the core of the pro-Israel, you know, vote in this country, as well as the Republican Party. You know, there's a lot here to unwrap. I mean, Tucker Carlson has always been hostile to Israel, but when he was at Fox, he kept it under wraps. And now, now there's no filter. And, you know, the person he had on to denounce Israel is somebody who supported the October 7th massacres, who is, you know, and, you know, he talked about Christians in Bethlehem. Well, the Christians in Bethlehem have been decimated since the Palestinian Authority took over Bethlehem. Christian life, you know, thrives inside of Israel. So, you know, it's kind of nuts to even go there. But I think the main point that we're dealing with this week is something that you led with, you know, with Trump's comments, stated in typical Trumpian, you know, fashion.
Right.
But
very
the truth
nuanced.
Is this administration, no matter who you think needs their heads examined, the Biden administration has turned on Israel. Immediately after October 7th, Biden said the right thing, supporting Israel, supporting the eradication of Hamas. In 6 months, he's flipped. He's gone 180. And he is basically threatening. He's doing exactly what the left, the hard left, the anti-Israel left, the intersectional radical left, the squad wanted all along by threatening Israel with aid cuts if they finish off Hamas in Gaza. And basically reading from Hamas propaganda talking points to do so. Now, that's really interesting. Number one, because it threatens the whole U.S.-Israel alliance. But it's also granting a victory to Hamas. If they are still standing when this war is over, they win. They get away with mass murder of October 7th. But more than that, they become the strong horse among the Palestinians. If you actually believe in the possibility of peace, that's over, because Hamas has only two goals, the eradication of Israel and the genocide of its Jewish population. So it's really interesting that what we've seen in the last 5 years, you know, when the original four members of the squad entered Congress in January 2019, you know, Democrats were telling people like me who were raising an alarm about this, saying, oh, you got it wrong. They're outliers. You know, most Democrats are overwhelmingly pro-Israel. You can count on us. Well, in 5 short years, the squad has gone mainstream. And now it's the pro-Israel members of the Democratic Party, someone like John Fetterman, who I never believed that I would actually wind up praising, but I certainly am praising him now. Yeah. It's Fetterman who is the outlier within the Democratic Party, and the squad's views are mainstream. Biden has totally, you know, he's governed for the last 3+ years as if he's enthralled to the left on domestic issues, on open borders and economics and everything else. But now, with respect to Israel, because he foolishly believes that if he isn't, you know, really anti-Israel, if he doesn't flip on Israel, he'll lose the election because he'll lose all the left-wing voters who hate Israel. He thinks he's going to lose. He's got to beat Netanyahu before he beats Trump. That's nuts, because there are far more pro-Israel votes in the center of this country than to be lost on the left for being insufficiently hostile to Israel.
Well, that's
what he's doing.
Well, that's why, you know, Trump said, you know, it's blunt and it may lack the nuance, as often the case. But I mean, honestly, he's, as usual, directionally correct. I mean, sort of what you're describing is, you know, minus the chanting and the hyperventilating, the position that you're hearing from Elizabeth Warren and from the Biden administration generally, its surrogates, is indistinguishable from the temper tantrums you're seeing on college campuses or in the streets of major cities.
You're absolutely right. And it's just another version of the same thing. And in fact, it is the mobs, you know, in the streets blocking bridges and tunnels and demonstrating, you know, on college campuses, you know, chanting from the river to the sea, you know, for the destruction of Israel, intifada, globalized intifada, which means terrorism against Jews everywhere. These are the people whom Biden is afraid of. He's not afraid of the vast majority of Americans who are pro-Israel and who want to see the terrorists defeated. He's afraid of the radicals. That's an odd way to govern. But when you're living inside the left-wing bubble, that is the White House right now, where you believe everything that you read in the New York Times and hear on MSNBC, you think the world is coming to the end if the radical left is angry at you. He, you know, 30-odd years ago, Bill Clinton, I wrote a piece about this a couple of weeks ago, 30-odd years ago, Bill Clinton established his credibility as a candidate by having what was known as a sister soldier moment, where he
announced
this radical activist, you know, who was calling for the murder of policemen, and everybody said, "Oh, Clinton is not, you know, he's not enthralled to the left. He's a normal person. Maybe we can vote for him." Right now, Democrats don't believe in sister soldier moments. They believe in bowing to the left. That's what Biden has been doing. You know, he sent, you know, a delegation to the pro-Hamas mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, to apologize for his pro-Israel policies, his initial pro-Israel policies. You know, it's an administration that has its priorities all out of whack. You know, not just about Israel, but certainly about Israel now, and it's blowing up the alliance with Israel. Whatever you think of Netanyahu, what he's doing is granting a victory to Hamas, and that's something no American president, no administration should do, no political party should want any part of.
Well, does Bibi need our help financially or supplying weapons, or do they need Biden and the U.S. for PR reasons?
They don't need Israel. You know, Israel doesn't need the United States for PR reasons. There are tangible reasons why it does need the United States. Israel is dependent on the United States for arms resupply, for the Iron Dome, and for all sorts of other weapon systems, and that is a dependence that the United States has encouraged and indeed enforced. They've discouraged Israel from further developing its own arms industry and not being independent, because they want Israel dependent. Obama wanted that, so Israel does need that. But Israel also relies on the United States to have its back at the United Nations, you know, which is, you know, it's certainly, you know, you can dismiss it as a talking shop. But if the UN Security Council passes resolution recognizing Palestinian statehood to the terrorists, or to, as many in the UN want, or basically, you know, having a ceasefire that is binding and would, you know, result in sanctions against Israel if it continued its campaign, that would be really damaging to Israel. And that's, yes, Israel does depend on the United States for that. And what they've learned in the last couple of months is that they can't depend on the United States while Joe Biden is in office and while he's so afraid of the left.
Jonathan Tobin, editor-in-chief of Jewish News Syndicate, JNS.org. Jonathan Tobin, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.